Welcome back to Bibliosynensis.
Hi, everybody.
Today we are joined with Ryan James.
Hi, everybody.
So you'll have to forgive us, but Ryan's waving to the camera right now.
Camera, the microphone.
The microphone. Sorry, he's. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Ryan.
Oh yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, so it's like every week, right? I mean, there's like a bunch of swing dancing. I swing dance. I compete in swing dancing. I try to align myself with the right people. Like I got like I'm BFFs with like some swing dance Hall of Famers, and a lot of people are like, I didn't know there was a Hall of Fame for swing dancing. Like, well, yeah, there's like a California Hall of Fame for swing dancing. There's a U.S. Hall of Fame for swing dancing. There's probably even like a European Hall of Fame for swing dancing. But when I'm not swing dancing, I'm also playing some Dungeons and Dragons. Well, a little more than that. I'm like dungeon mastering for Dungeons and Dragons. I haven't really been a player character in years, but I've been like a dungeon master every week for years. And people ask me like, it's normally backwards. Like the comic book shop where I volunteer for, they have a problem getting like dungeon masters because everybody wants to play, but not be like the dungeon master. It's kind of weird, but then I prefer being the dungeon master. And people ask me like, hey, why do you like being dungeon master so much? And I just tell them honestly, I just like being God.
My God.
That's a mouthful, my friend. So to get him a little acquainted with our teas, we actually had him sample it with a shot.
So for those of you that follow Tea Spectral on social media, we just finished our tea bar pop-up.
Yes.
And maybe I should take a picture of this, but Ryan is totally nursing the leftover bottle of rum that was infused with our tea today, which is tiki.
Yes.
Why don't you pour a shot in front of the mic so they can hear the gorgeous pour.
There it is. I don't know if that
picks up on the mic. Man. Oh, forget it. Just drink it.
Okay. So, yeah, Tiki, this is pretty much its last week along with Silk Bourbon.
Yes.
And we've had Tiki, I believe, in the past on Bibliosynensis. But it was a smash hit this past week.
Yeah, surprisingly.
So we made the cocktail, the Sunset Spritzer. And what Ryan is sampling right now is the, we had a Bacardi, and we actually infused tiki, like, the loose leaves in it, which is how we get a really concentrated tea flavor shot. So why don't you tell them how that tastes?
Wow, it tastes like it made Disney's Jungle Cruise, like, a lot more watchable.
Oh my God!
No!
That was not a bad movie, man! That was not.
Oh, God. So, we just finished watching The Jungle Cruise.
The dad jokes were superb.
It was super. They had a little bit of everything in it, in my opinion. So, it was great. But I'm not here to spoil things, right? But I'm having tiki iced, no spike. And what about you?
I'm having it iced. No spike either, but I can still remember the spritzer that we had during the event. So
the spritzer was basically inspired off of a pineapple mojito, and then we tried to make it seem like something out of a boba house, because that's been really inspiring us lately, and we put rainbow jelly in it.
Yes.
So it had the fresh mint and the rainbow jelly, and then we had the seltzer water, fresh cut lime, and I believe it was just iced tea tiki you could choose to have the shot. Ryan says, dash it all and just go straight for the shot.
Mm-hmm.
He is a true manly man. But we also brought Ryan onto this episode because, well, for one, we could hijack him from his busy jitterbugging career.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the National Jitterbug Championship is canceled?
Yeah, the National Jitterbug Championships, colloquially known as Camp Hollywood, was just canceled. as of last Friday. It's you know, I have my own team. I'm like the alpha of my own team right now. We compete in the team division, and we just we've been preparing just grinding, just like putting like our shoes to the floor, like real hard in rhythm, like every week.
So yeah. What did you call your? I know where this is going.
Oh, right. Coincidentally, our team name is Rhythm Smith. It's like Aerosmith, or for the younger kids, like Echo Smith, but it's Rhythm Smith.
Perfect. So we decided Ryan should be with us on this episode because we are talking about independent art publications. And how they shaped our generation and the things we learned from them. So we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons and zines and how the card game industry became a big thing, like Magic. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna actually freestyle it this time and just see where the conversation takes us.
I always thought that we freestyled everything.
We tried to follow a format, but I guess that just cannot contain us.
Nope.
But we will be doing this to the pleasurable Tiki. And hopefully Ryan doesn't pass out, because he is nursing these shots, let me tell you.
It's a Camp Hollywood, my friend.
No, yes.
Money. Clanking, clanking.
All right, so what was the first independent publication that you can remember that just wowed you? Like, you saw the pictures and the art and everything.
What, to find, like, examples of independent
publications? Comic books. Maybe. Well, how did you get into D&D?
Oh,
Catholic school.
What?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, explain.
They said something along the lines of, like, okay, don't do this game. I mean, there's been some bad stuff that happened. Like, I mean, there was, like, this one incident where people couldn't even, like, tell themselves apart now from their characters. Like, they actually thought they were the characters. And I was thinking, like, whoa, that's kind of scary. But then I found out, like, wow, you could be, like, a wizard and stuff. And I... thinking like I want to do magic, and let's do this thing that Catholic school told us not to do. Try it just once, and once became like I don't know 100 times, and then 1,000 like every time during a recess or at lunch, and people would like pass by us and they'd be like, what are you guys doing? And we'd just tell them Dungeons and Dragons, and then everyone would be like, ooh. You're doing something you're not supposed to be doing, and they're like, yeah, we are.
Wait, so you would do this at school?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the faculty knew, but they did nothing about it?
Oh, no, this was, like, our classmates, but it's like everyone had this, like, code of on, like, snitches get stitches, so we, Dungeons and Dragons, are our way throughout, like, all year round.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, what about you?
Myself? I guess I needed to ante up, and I actually became part of the strategics game club in high school.
Cool.
It was literally to test out my teacher's board game.
Was it a board game, or was it like an instructional...
Yeah, okay, it was like... It was like Warhammer, but World War II.
Okay.
I always played Nazi, just because I was crazy enough to actually wait for recruitment and, like, backup, which never came! Freaking, like...
How dare they?
They always freaking bomb the bridges. I'm like, I get it, it's historically correct, but... Really? I could have used that backup.
See, what I keep thinking about is how... Everybody kind of almost had, like, an Angel Fire account in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their artwork, and then there was DeviantArt, and there was all these different things. And then people actually published this stuff. Mm. That was crazy. And then you'd have, like, all these independent, like, art pieces that you would, like, go to the local, I guess, coffee shops or, like, local, like, stationery shops, and they would be selling these people's art books. Mm-hmm. Huh. I guess those were the early zines, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they were.
I mean, I remember when I first moved into this town, and we were like, let's try all the local cafes, and first thing we found was, like, a couple of printed out on, like, photocopy of, like, art pieces. And, like, their random characters and their handles.
Mm.
That's what I remember.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
An art piece that actually stuck out to me when I was just, I guess, starting out into the book world was, ironically, Yoshitaka Amano's illustration of Neil Gaiman's Sandman.
Wow.
Yeah. So, that was beautifully done. Originally, the artwork was just drawn because Yoshitaka Amano loved the artwork, you know, loved his illustration style and just wanted to keep publishing it. And Neil Gaiman just added it to his story.
And then, just for reference, this is a guy who did Vampire Hunter D, right?
Vampire Hunter D and all the Final Fantasy title artwork.
Hmm.
So, like, you really have to be kind of a real fan to remember Vampire Hunter D, but everyone remembers Final Fantasy.
Cool.
Yep. So, what stuck out to you the most when you actually started on all this? Like, not the one that inspired you, but the one that kind of, like, you brought with you even till today.
I mean, I never followed it, but I was so amazed by the medium of it was the whole Dot Hack series.
Oh my god.
Hear me out. I mean, it was just so cool that it kind of transitioned from comic book to, I think they had a card game at one point.
Video game.
There was a video game. And then they even had, like, a radio drama at some point. It was, like, all kinds of different mediums, but you had to follow it that way.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so cool. That's definitely one that, till this day, like, sticks out to me. The other one would be Serial Experiment Lane. Mm. How it never even really had a comic book, but people had to go live and observe it. And because so many people blogged about it, there was fan art of it, and then there were zines of it, yeah. And that is actually how it gained its international audience.
Yeah.
But if any of you are not familiar, Serial Experiment Lane literally started out as like a 24-hour digital live stream of an anime girl hooked up to computers.
PlayStation, actually.
Yeah, PlayStation. Was it PlayStation or was it?
PlayStation 1. It was. You were only allowed to use it in, like, the Japanese consoles, and you'd have to be connected to their server.
Yeah, and then there was, like, one point where you could just, like, check in on her, but it became so, I guess, eerie, mysterious that they made a 13-part series anime for it.
Yeah.
Explaining her origin stories, and, like, this was at the time of conspiracies, and the internet is evil, and the Matrix was a big thing, so, like, alternate, like, realities were another huge thing. But all of that wouldn't have actually been popular if it weren't for the bloggers and the zine people that created the artwork.
I think what they did was they made it attractive. Because before, people like that were, like, seen as weird and kind of scary. You know, like a bunch of guys staying in their basements wearing, like, baseball caps and, like, two-strapping their backpacks and, like, heaving with their mouths open. And, like, people were like, what are they doing in there? And literally they were just conspiring.
Yeah.
Like, they just had, like, crazy theories, and they just loved surrealism so much that it basically melded together.
Yeah, it was really cool. Till this day, I just love Lane, period. Like, anything Lane is just so... I mean, it just... The whole vibe of it is just bursting with this creative energy. And it's always, like, a little above its time.
Right.
But that also reminds me, around that time, I got into the Starcatcher series with Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that was actually, I think, Ryan, that is the first kind of book club we actually had, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. totally started book club, just like watching, just reading the Starcatcher series. I still have those. I like how those books were designed. It's like those pages were designed to look like they were weathered, the edges anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we got into it because you are a pen.
Oh yeah,
collector. That's me. And just the myths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally love the Peter Pan mythos.
Mm-hmm. But I guess I segued into that because what are some of the things that got you into that?
I like that the aesthetics. I mean, there's like a whole world. You got these like these lost boys, and you got these pirates, right? And then you got these fairies, mm-hmm. Fairy community. And then you got the natives of Neverland who are just like contemporary of like some real world like indigenous peoples.
So have mm-hmm. you ever read the original book?
Oh yeah, I read the original book, the original novel. I even got I have a sweater somewhere. It says Lost Boys, established 1904.
Nice.
I even got it. Somewhere in my room, I even have like the only authorized sequel to Peter Pan, which is like. Like a whole century later, it was like
Peter Scarlet.
Peter Scarlet. Mm-hmm, yeah,
I haven't read that yet.
Oh, that's kind of weird. You gave that to me as a present.
I know. I've always been like, I'm gonna get around to reading it, and then you know,
never did.
Which, by the way, can I just make a confession, gentlemen, that we recently reorganized our office and. We had to sort books because we had to move a lot of things out, unfortunately. But I didn't realize how big my TBR pile was until I did that. And I have to confess that I think about a third of the books that are left are all TBR.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't get rid of them. I'm sorry.
That's so... Okay. Yeah, because like the books I kept, like, which basically are like in my drawers now,
mm-hmm.
are the books I return to frequently. Mm-hmm. Like, I can keep buying more books, but I'll keep reading these books while I keep buying. You know? Mm-hmm. It just never ends for my repetition, I guess. It's just, I'm that kind of reader.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Ryan, what kind of reader are you?
Oh, I'll read my book. I read my books one at a time, because then, like, if I move on to the second book, I feel like I'm cheating on my first book. But it's kind of like, you know, but then I also will have like a pile of books, like a queue of books to read after this book that I'm reading, and it's like I'm waiting to entertain these suitors that are books.
Yeah, I feel you.
Mm-hmm.
Like okay. I said, a third of mine are those kind of books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
I would like to actually talk about the application of art in books.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you're into Dungeons & Dragons. Oh, you're a dungeon master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Master.
Yeah, you right. have these illustrations in these books. Mm-hmm. They're, what, published every year, is it?
Oh, yeah. Like, there's like a new book that comes out seasonally.
Okay, tell us a little bit about why they do that. And what is the whole point of, like, having so many Dungeons & Dragons, like, books and art books?
Oh, yeah, cool. I mean, like, right now, like, we're currently on the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons, and these editions, they correspond to, like, Dungeons & Dragons novels, right?
Okay.
It's like, so, like, we're, like, right now, like, any novels, published during this fifth edition era are like they take place like years later after like previous popular Dungeons and Dragons novels, right? So we're in that world, for example. It's a way to be able to flesh out this whole world, really. And we know what world we're in, like what kind of sometimes they like the authors of these adventure books like to take some well-known characters from the novels and have them like in make some cameo appearances as NPCs, like that stands for non-player characters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty cool. Like sometimes like I'm dungeon mastering and I'm trying to like sometimes not all dungeon masters are good with words. So it's like it's pretty cool when you got these pictures in the books and then you can just like it's like being a kid again, like coloring, doing a coloring book where you color within the lines, but and then show it off to an audience and be like, this place is supposed to look like this.
Right.
And conveniently, the author had like an illustrator illustrate what that environment looks.
Right.
And it's really cool. It's like it makes our job easier when we're dungeon mastering.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So. Anyways, this might be off subject, but I remember you used to be proud of how you would slightly alter these books.
Oh, yeah. I would always refer to this as my director's cut.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. It's like
and one I particularly remember, which I think is very appropriate with what Netflix has released, is you did a Twilight-inspired Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
so how'd that work out?
So there's a very popular Dungeons & Dragons adventure. It's it takes place in a world called Ravenloft. And Ravenloft is a gothic-themed campaign. It's got a popular character named Strahd. Count Strahd is like a vampire who's like ranked as one of the top Dungeons and Dragons villains of all time. And I looked at it, and this like I think the original adventure was printed in the 70s, and so now it was just a couple years ago it was re-released as a new adventure, revisiting that world, fleshing that world out more. And I'm thinking like I looked at this like I was prepping the adventure for my players. I was, because I'm doing my dungeon mastering duties. I kind of skimmed it, and the more I skimmed it, I wasn't even paying attention to it. And like I kind of got attention deficit where like I saw that there were like werewolves in the campaign, and I just kind of like threw the plot out, and I realized I'm gonna have a bunch of werewolves here, you're like team werewolf or team Strahd,
right?
Because like the whole plot is Strahd's backstory is that he loves a girl, and things don't go his way, but in this plot there's an option where like maybe one of your player characters is reminds Count Strahd of the girl that he loved. So I'm thinking like, oh, sweet love triangle, vampire versus werewolves, yeah.
All right.
And how did it go? I mean, I never heard after that. Like, did they enjoy it or?
Oh, maybe a couple of my players claimed that they were having an aneurysm, but I think that was kind of embellished because, like, it's not like we called 911 for them during the during the session. I mean,
so technically, you didn't call 911. So henceforth, they did not this. They did not have this aneurysm whatsoever.
No,
exactly.
There are no proofs, my friend.
No.
I dare you to actually show me proof.
Yeah, I remember like there was a one incident that resulted in notoriety, is that the word? So the comic book shop that I'm running this at, the comic book shop has a rule that supersedes all like creative control, where like there's no player versus player allowed, right?
Right.
Okay, I'm thinking like I'm all about consent, and so like at my table like so like with the whole like allegory from the political struggle between vampires and morality and all that. Two of my players came into a disagreement, and they both consented to like attack each other. I'm like, all right, cool, just duke it out. When you're done, we'll get on the adventure. And like, holy crap, my friend Jason, who I still keep in contact with, he was playing a ranger, and the ranger has like. This at a certain level has like this multi attack, right?
Oh.
And the thing is, like, dude, I mean, this guy, I mean,
He kind of shot one of the other players down, called his multi-attack, and well, the way that the Dungeons & Dragons game mechanics are set up, like, that one player that was down, I mean, he was just automatically failing his death saving throws with each arrow strike, and, oh, wow, we kind of just sat there in silence, and I had to do this so-called walk of shame where I march over to the person in charge and explain to them, like, one of my players is permanently dead.
Oops.
Oh, no.
I know I'm supposed to be responsible, but no. No, I'm sorry.
I guess a little bit of this.
Alright. Well, I think I've, like, refilled my cup, like, 3 times, so... Cheers.
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 There goes a little bit of the tiki concentrates.
Mm-hmm. Oop. Okay, Bella. There you go. It's okay. It's okay. Just to let everybody know that we are actually in the shed.
Yeah, we're recording in the Mambo, so if you hear our waterfall or the dogs or some crickets, then that's that.
That is that. We are outdoors. My God.
Just living our extra lives, drinking tea in a shed.
And all thanks to your support. Like, seriously, like... Your support's, like, given us a lot of amazing things, and
mm-hmm.
we're so happy that T-Spectral's actually been able to grow like this.
Yes.
So, what about you, Steph? Have you actually played RPGs?
Not in the Dungeons & Dragons sense, I guess. I've done card games, but
okay,
nothing as elaborate.
Ah.
Though I am really curious about one that just came out, which is very appropriate to this episode's theme. I happened to read a few comic books that are based on this universe called Tea Dragons.
Mm.
And it was a really cool concept because it's about this land where they have these mystical... We're going to have to cut this out.
What?
They have mystical beasts, and, they're dragons that are based on tea, and it's interesting because they'll create, tea that is more superior than anything else based on your memories, and they imprint on you, and they become your familiar.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And that's why you have to have kind of like a coven or a small clan of other tea dragon owners,
mm-hmm.
because you have to trust them with your past memories, because when they harvest the tea to drink it, they can actually
tap
into your memories like a pensieve.
That's mm-hmm. interesting.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all done in this cute little Lolita style. And there's two books out so far. I think there's a third one I haven't read yet, but they just turned it into a card game.
Huh.
And they literally did these comic books specifically to release this card game.
Wow.
And just get people into it. And the back of each of these comic books have, like, the field guide as to, like, the levels of strength in each dragon or what they're famous for or what, like, you know, how to take care of these dragons. So there's, like, an Earl Grey dragon, there's an Oolong dragon... There's a chamomile dragon. It's pretty cool.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, so I will probably end up playing that game sometime soon.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Card games. I did end up getting Gloom, which is... Some of it's based on fairy tales. And, like, ghost legends.
Yes.
Which I got Eugene into Gloom. But thank you, Mary, by the way. Miss Mary Lou recommended Gloom. But, Ryan, you need to play with us. Gloom is cool. This card game where you get basically you get your own family, mm-hmm. and they're all miserable, weird people, and the point of the game is to make your character suffer more than the others while you're trying to kill off other people.
No, you're trying to make your character, your families, suffer less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, in the end, the person who has the most points is because they've, like, tacked on all these death, like, miserable points before they died.
Yeah, and the loser has to actually tell the story of, like, the most miserable family member that got to live.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
So, it's totally macabre, but if anyone's into, like, the whole vibe of Adam's Family meet, like, dark fairy tales and legends, this is the card game for you. In fact, I do want to get it, but they do have a Lovecraft extension pack.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, the silly thing about Lovecraft is, you know me, I'm like crazy for Neil Gaiman. He actually did an intro for him, and out of all the things he could have written when you read his intro to Lovecraft's book, he actually writes, he's not that great of a read. You'll realize if you're a, you know, if you're a sci-fi or fantasy reader, that he borrows a lot from other stories.
Mm-hmm.
What's intriguing about him are his monsters. But before you get to those, you will be bored. And I'm just like, wow!
That's some shade.
I know, man! I was like, how old were you when you wrote this? Like, this is some, like, you know, this is some, like, twisted goth issue. Like, you haven't actually dealt with here. Like, is your inner child speaking, Gaiman? Is that what happened? Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Sorry, you brought up Lovecraft.
Right.
As for, like, other RPGs, because, you know, I guess I've dealt with strategy games a lot. I mean, I remember even playing the Pokemon card game. But the one that stuck out to me was, like, this really stupid game that my brother brought when we were all going to college.
This is going.
Oh, God, that was so dumb.
I think I played this with you once.
Yes. It was called Ninja Pizza.
Yes, and it got really popular, too, because, again, let's talk about art and media. There was so much fan art behind it.
Yes.
That it had an occult following. This was before memes.
Yes.
And people would make stupid fan art online, and then there was a point where people made, like, really stupid Flash games.
Oh, that's the name. Ninja Burger. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I remember this.
Yeah. So, the weird thing was, you had to create your own platforms. And then, if you failed, you'd commit seppuku. Now, the crazy thing about the game was, it had to be a drinking game. It had to be. Because every time you had dishonored your clan for getting caught, because ninjas aren't supposed to be seen, you gotta, like, jump on a table and cluck and, like, scream. Or, like, just do something entirely embarrassing to just show that you actually are sorry. And basically, if you don't finish within the 30 minutes that this game demands you to actually finish, then you have failed your mission, even if you actually completed the whole mission.
Huh.
It was like, this sounds like a frat boy that just thought, oh my god, like, I could make a game. and it sold. I'm like, oh my god, nerds, what have you, like, reached? Like, what type of, like, epoch did our culture, like, go towards? Am I really in the time of where nerds have become comedians, and comedians have become birds.
Yeah, well, look at now.
Yeah, I know. Here we are.
It's over.
Now we've just, like, all we do is share.
We fold circled.
Oh, my goodness. And the thing was, I remember you were getting mad at me back at the anime conventions when we used to do Artist Alley for just doing dumb stuff like that.
Yeah, it was embarrassing.
I mean, you wanted to be taken as a serious artist, but I just was getting tired of having no sales. And, oh my god. Moment of silence, please.
Jesus.
Alright, back to culture.
No, you're good. I mean, this has just been a flat-out nerd-out session, hasn't it?
Yes, yes. I mean, if anything, I really just want to understand that, you know, or at least discuss the point that books and art just coincide together so well. I mean, I guess, let's talk about, I don't know, book illustrations that actually led to just applications of how people interpret things. I mean, the illustrations for Pride and Prejudice. Okay.
I didn't even know there were illustrations.
There were illustrations. They are, like, rampant online if you could find, like, if you just search them. You know? And they're gorgeous art pieces, and it literally has, like, become, like, the easiest way for people to just kind of reference as to what Regency people wear. I mean, people have had so much fun with it. We have Bridgerton now.
And oh, Bridgerton.
I know. It, like, as the as a theater minor and just, like, historian, it, like, it's such a cringe when it comes down to the fashion. It's like going to Ren Faire and thinking, oh, it's going to be totally English garb. No.
The lies.
The lies they tell.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Half the dresses in that show are, like, flapper.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, but, okay. To be fair, there was a resurgence of Regency, like, philia during the 1920s.
Okay.
So, some 1920s outfits were inspired by the Jane Austen era.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if you watch Snow White, the reason why her outfit was designed the way it was because she was a flapper, but also they were, like, totally obsessed with that time period.
Which explains why she had the short hair and why she acted like...
And, yeah.
Yeah, like... Almost practically like Daisy from Gatsby.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was always wondering about that. Because I'm like, I'm pretty sure medieval women weren't like that when you read them in, like, you know, even the Grimm novels, you know? The Brother Grimm novels.
Right.
So.
Well, I'd like to bring up, since we're talking about art and independent and media and such, Nima Lima.
Oh my god.
And how not many people, even till now, people don't know that name unless you're a Harry Potter fanatic, since we're going to show our age and we're all showing off our millennial pride at this point. I mean, we all have annual passes, let's be honest, to Universal.
Yes.
And what's the one thing we do? We just hang out at Hogsmeade.
All right, everybody. Go to your Google and actually say Lumos. You'd be surprised what your phone does.
Oh, yes. It's awesome. It will actually turn off and on your battery.
Your flashlight.
Yeah. But Nima Lima blows my mind. I believe they originally started designing retellings of fairy tales. But Rowling discovered them because at the time, again, she was taking care of her daughter and she was writing Harry Potter, but when it came down to the concept art for the movies, she actually approached them to design the way that these things would work. So a lot of the original sketches for, like, even the way Whimsy Alley opened, or all the packaging in Honeydukes, all of that is Nima Lima.
But did she really discover her?
I don't know. I have to say, Rowling's taste, I mean, I get her. I mean, the fact that I just recently discovered that the cursed child is all Imogen, he redid. Yes. I'm like, okay, you got me, because I love her music, period.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I forgot who the original illustrator was for Harry Potter, like the chapter books. Mm-hmm. That stuff's, like, iconic.
Okay.
But now, I think it's fascinating that she's given them free rein to just go in and redo all the books.
Wait, what do you mean?
So, Nima Lima is going in and doing pop-up books of all of the Harry Potter books now.
Oh, yes, I remember seeing that.
I have the first book, but yeah. It's just incredible artwork.
Yeah.
So, it literally feels like... Which I think is kind of surreal. So imagine if we walked into Hogsmeade as the Wizarding World universe.
Right.
And we went into Flourish and Blotts, and we picked up a pop-up book on the legend of Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And it would look like it fit in the world because it was designed by the same people that designed Honeydukes and Whimsy Alley and... Mm. All these crazy things.
Yeah.
And it's just this crazy full circle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fabulous.
Mm. Yeah. I just wanted to throw that out there. Because I feel like Warner Brothers really tried to make it as dark as possible. I think just to sell to the older audience as they aged. But Harry Potter, to me, will always be just ridiculous and colorful.
Oh, speaking of ridiculous and colorful, like, sharing Howl's Moving Castle and Kiki's Delivery Service has been, like, intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know the authors, like, both of them, okay, the authoress of Kiki's Delivery Service and the authoress for Howl's Moving Castle were both dissatisfied with Miyazaki's interpretation.
Yep.
And because of it, they've written more books just to actually perpetuate their ideal of the world, which is actually a lot more ridiculous than, you know, than Miyazaki actually had it. And it feels almost like Miyazaki took on, like, the vision of a video game and used whimsy stories to illustrate his ideals of how that philosophy works for him. You know, like, you know how it is? Like video games are very much like, oh, it has to be heroic. You know, it's all about the hero, and it's gotta be a battle somewhere, or else it's just not gonna sell.
Mm-hmm.
But these stories have, like, the battles aren't even, like, battles. And when you actually see some of the original illustrations for them, like, I kind of felt like I was, like, ready to read, like, Thomas the Train.
Thomas, what?
Have you seen the original illustrations? They're, like, you know, Chibi Maruka-chan, like, illustrations.
Oh.
You know? Oh. Like, okay, for audiences, the one that, like, if you guys actually grew up with, like, Hot Topic, it's like that cute little Japanese girl that would actually give you sass, and it's just, it's, like, based on this Japanese TV series of Chibi Maruko-chan. I think I'm saying it right. I think. I could be saying it wrong. But it's just a very simple art style for kids to actually understand modern Japanese lifestyle. But anyways, it looks like that.
Hmm.
And to, like, I don't know, have Howl become, like, this wailing Scottish kid that just goes emo, like, almost every 5 minutes and, like, moves his house because he doesn't want to pay taxes. is like,
oh, he moves his house because he doesn't want the king to constantly visit him.
Right. But he would be the type to actually sell the house just to so he wouldn't have to pay for anything.
Yeah, that is him.
Yeah, that's him. You know? But I guess I just wanted to actually bring that up because I'm just... It's just intriguing over, like, how visions of the author and visions by the producers just totally make completely different worlds. And it's come to the point where even J.K. Rowling only, you know, only gets her support mainly from publication. And the movies are practically owned by the studios.
Well, let's be honest, it's kind of a great thing.
Yes. Yes.
But let's not get into that.
Okay.
I'm a Gryffindor.
Yeah.
All right, get out.
We random trivia, we had Bella sorted.
Oh.
She's a Slytherin.
Yeah, daddy's girl. Okay.
Glad we still have Despero.
Oh my gosh.
You're the greatest Gryffindor doggy uncle anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If anyone would be willing to compete for that kind of brash behavior, it'd be you.
So, Ryan, did the artwork at all reflect your want to read the Harry Potter books?
Oh. No. I mean, I just like the commercials advertising the movies looked cool.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did the artwork to Twilight's books urge you to actually read Twilight?
No.
Okay.
It was the shirtless Jacob Black.
Actually, I was back in the day, I because of like movie prices, I could never just go to the movie theaters and watch one movie. So I would always have to go to the movie theater and just like watch at least like two other movies after the movie that I paid for, and just one day, like on the schedule, there was like no other choice except Twilight. So I walked into the first Twilight movie that way, and I thought, wow, this is kind of cool. Passes the time. I mean, there's the bad guy is the bully from the TV show The OC. Yeah,
I never thought
this
of that.
This got my attention. All right, this is the guy that used to punk out Ryan Atwood, who would later grow up to play Commissioner Gordon on Gotham. Like, okay, yeah, I will follow this guy in his career. I mean, like, he only lasted for one movie, but that's what got my attention. Then there was that cliffhanger. I'm like, okay, I'll give part two a chance. And that's when part two was, like, really changed my life. I mean, part two, they introduced the werewolves, right? I mean, this, like, pubescent kid from Twilight Part 1, all of a sudden, like, he gets muscles, because, like, in between movies, they told him, like, hey, man, they changed the directors, and the new director of Twilight Part 2, which was called New Moon, like,
right.
they were thinking about recasting him, and the actor, Taylor Lautner, like, no, I've been working out, I got this. Like, so between Twilight Part 1 and Part 2, he put on literally 30 pounds of muscle, not like the figuratively, but the literal, literally 30 pounds of muscle. Mm. And it was just like this brown kid with hair, and then all of a sudden, like, his other werewolves were like these indigenous folk who got like the tan boys with black hair. And then, I mean, throughout my whole life, like in Eurocentric Hollywood, like, nobody like looked at me twice, but all of a sudden, like, Twilight, New Moon comes out, and just out of nowhere, chicks be looking at me like, hey. I'm like, hey. sup? And I'm like, I'm like, people don't even know my name. They're like, hey, Jacob. I'm like, how do you know my name? First of all, it's not named Jacob, but how do you know my name? and like, yeah, I'll, yeah, sure, I'm Jacob, yeah. What do you want? And it took me a while to figure it out. But like, whoa, this movie is like getting me attention. All right, I'll watch. I'll be a fan. Like, not an Harry Potter. We fans call ourselves Potterheads. Okay, what are we gonna call ourselves in Twilight? And they said, oh, we call ourselves Twihards. I'm like, okay, that's what I'm advertising myself as, and I could never say it. I can never say with a straight face, but yeah, I'm a twi.
Now you can say it with pride. I remember when you came to support me and Eugene at the anime conventions, because we do like live speaking, right? And you're like, okay, well, I'm going to cosplay. And after that, you were like, here's a picture of Jacob's tattoo. I need you to put it on with Sharpie.
Oh, mm-hmm,
and yeah. I just remember sitting in the lobby drawing that on your arm. It was the funniest thing. And you just, like, walked around the convention shirtless the whole time.
Hey, it caught people's attention.
With the werewolf tattoo, yeah, it was pretty cool. I got this, like, nostalgia because, like, I grew up on watching Sailor Moon, and like this one Sailor Moon cosplayer was just like talking to me like, oh hey, this is the best day ever. And then there's like, I remember like this one douchebag cosplaying Mario was like, hey man, you're at the wrong con. I'm like, no I'm not, this has been adapted to a manga.
Ooh. And it was.
And he tries to step up to me and like, and I could have like defended myself, but Sailor Moon steps up to him like, blah 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 blah, and I couldn't even hear what she said. I just like, I saw Sailor Moon just like telling this guy off, and that was all that mattered. And this is like a Super Mario douchebag just had to go away because like all of a sudden like hey hot chick be telling you go.
You're like, leave us alone.
My wife who has spoken.
This was an interesting, I guess, trip down memory lane. I'm sad that we didn't get to talk more about zines. I just feel like they're such a big part of that independent life, I guess you could say.
Well, to be honest, I feel like zines might actually require more of a centralized attention.
Yeah, but I just feel like the indie scene and things getting adapted visually and into books, like, most of it started in zines.
Well, okay, let's bring this up. Like, which zine are you actually, envisioning?
Well, okay, so one I remember very distinctly is there's this little unknown Chinatown artist that would draw Robin.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, someone in the studios discovered him, and his little zine actually got him to illustrate the Teen Titans.
Oh, I remember that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or how you and I would go to the independent toy factories, and no, I don't mean it that way. Get your mind out of the gutter. I'm talking about independent vinyl action figures. And a lot of those artists got picked up, and that's actually how they designed Samurai Jack through most of that.
Huh.
Okay. But it all just was like underground culture, independent culture begets illustrations, begets novels, begets writing.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And how a lot of the new card games are influenced by even just memes on the internet now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole actual card game about memes.
Yes.
Now. It's like Cards Against Humanity, but fill in the blank of your favorite memes.
True. I mean, when it comes down to zines, I just kept thinking about, like, you know, people that actually created, like, cosplay magazines or, like, independent film magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And how there was always a connection for a niche market, and it led us to a lot of new discoveries. I mean, like, I remember not understanding Lolita culture for the longest time. And all of a sudden, they're just, like, taking photos everywhere. Everywhere. Not just at the conventions, but, like, at hotels, at tea shops, restaurants, and, you know, some people were, like, trying to treat them like they're fetishized models, but it was literally a lifestyle and a fashion. And to be honest, like, I felt like you know, the ideal of steampunk actually was kind of solidified due to that.
But see how everything was kind of solidified by, like, what you could buy?
Yeah.
Like, remember the Gothic Lolita Bible?
Yes.
Was, like, that is the only way you could have learned about Japanese Lolita fashion back then.
Yeah, now we have baby metal.
Yeah. Ryan.
But, yeah, I felt like it gave a lot of people opportunity, and I felt also that people that had no chance whatsoever were able to get ahead due to that kind of support.
Well, here's a random thought I just realized. Do you think that the mixed medium of book to film, or film to book, or blog, or fandom was important back then because the internet wasn't so, like, big of a thing?
Yes. I mean,
what do you think, Ryan?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, like, hear me out. You used to go to Borders.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, in fact, there were days when, if ever I wasn't mad at you, I'm like, I know Ryan is reading this one copy here. And if I buy it, he won't have a copy to read. I never did it, but it was just like, I could totally tell you were thumbing the chapter. Random thoughts. Mm-hmm. The little shenanigans we went through in our teenage angst. But that's where we got all our news. Like, even Twilight, do you remember? Like, I was just thinking about that, because there's all these TikToks now about Twilight, and when the movie was adapted. And do you remember how Borders had, like, literally everything Twilight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I never thought about how bad it actually was until, like, I kind of took a trip down memory lane. Like, there was Twilight jewelry. There was Twilight, God, what did they have? They even had candles, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a point where they took some of the classics, which I think is kind of interesting, but they took a lot of classic novels and they republished it with covers that would match the Twilight series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But, Ryan, any insight? Like, when do you think the internet just really kind of took a turn and just, I guess, started feeding media for what it was?
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's probably an arbitrary number, maybe 2015.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But was there, like, a particular series? Because, I mean, one thing I'm thinking about, which was kind of a big, I guess, book renaissance, was Game of Thrones.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
when the show came out, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking, like, I know one big deal with that fandom is that, I know, like, the author, George R. Martin, he's, like, he gets criticized by his own fans as not being able to finish a novel to save his life. I mean, the novels had a great head start over the show, and then all of a sudden, finally, the show caught up to the novels, and then it's like, wow, this is great. I mean,
yeah. It just reminds me of one of my favorite authors, Diana Setterfield. She wrote one really good novel, The 13th Tale, and it was so good. And everyone swore to God that she was going to die before she wrote novel.
I mean, have you seen her? She's not exactly like the, you know, a petite. Like,
oh,
you know,
but what shook me is she came out with Bellman in Black, which I have yet to read, and then I thought I'd, like, check in with her again. And now she's writing a freaking trilogy, and now I'm getting nervous.
Oh, no.
So, we'll see. But anyways, back to Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah, I mean, just eventually just got to the point where, like, okay, we need to air the new season now. Now the new season is, like, the first season that is not based on the source material, because the source material was not even written yet.
Yeah.
But, and I remember, like, the only time I had ever gone through that with franchise's fan base was that franchise True Blood. It was the novels, what are called the Sookie Stackhouse novel. Sookie Stackhouse is the name of the main character of True Blood, mm-hmm. the HBO show that it was adapted from. And I remember, like, everyone loved season one of True Blood. It was, like, faithful to the books. And even the series looked good, and it was like accurate to the books according to the book readers. And then I don't know, it was like everyone says like season three is like where the divergence happened, where like now the show was its own story and it had nothing to do with the books. And
oh man,
yeah, no, I feel you. I mean, I feel like the Nickelodeon version of Series Unfortunate Events was good, but it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. And so they, like, went out of their way to create the Netflix series that we have now.
Oh my god, that show was amazing.
Which I love, because Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, is super, I guess, cryptic when it comes down to talking about the past characters, which can get really frustrating. And he even has, like, the Beatrice letters, which I was reading, and that was really confusing to begin with, because I guess he just gets so into his head that it took me a while to come to grips with who was who in the Beatrice letters.
Yes.
And then here's this Netflix show, and they finally get to show all the characters behind the scenes of the Baudelaires, because I guess this is a nice spoiler. I wouldn't call it a spoiler, but newsflash, yes, it is shown through the perspective of the Baudelaire orphan, Series of Unfortunate Events, but it has very little to do with the Baudelaires.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with the secret society that their parents were involved with.
Right.
And you get to see more of that in the Netflix series. So it's less just one person perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's intriguing. Because I think it goes back to that formula of a Moby Dick, you know? The narrator isn't the person that's actually going through the adventure. But because he's narrating it, we're able to actually follow the journey and actually feel what it's like to be there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel like that's actually just really good storytelling, because the most interesting things in most novels are the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give away the mystery, you know, the surprise is just over with. Like, you can't enjoy the rest of the story after that.
Right.
What's a story that you actually got to enjoy because of the surprising, twist or ending?
Like a plot twist you wouldn't have expected, or
just an enjoyable plot twist?
Oh my goodness, the ending of The Looking Glass Wars. Mm. It just ended so satisfactory, and I was like, finally, an author that knows how to write an ending.
Oh my gosh, right?
What about you, Ryan?
I mean, it's not like a catastrophic surprise twist, but it's kind of like, it was like a nice, wholesome type of redirect, Paper Towns.
Wow, really?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I always think his stuff ends horribly, but that's good to know.
Oh yeah, like aside from the stuff that ends horribly, Paper Towns ends well.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, I will have to check that out then.
Okay, what's that? What's that movie? An Education.
Hmm.
I read the book, and there's actually more to the ending, and it felt kind of awkward. And I'm really happy they didn't put it in the movie. Where the gentleman that, she figures out that is basically just going to give her, like, this terrible future, becoming his wife or baby mama, practically,
mm-hmm.
Still thinks about her and comes to see her in college. And she gets to say goodbye to him personally, and kind of like, you know, leaves, you know, ends the story with a triumphant feministic, I guess, ideal of, you know, what a victory must feel like, which I felt, you know, deterred from the ending of the book, because she really didn't need him, and she didn't really need that validation, I felt.
Oh, I have one that's really strange, since you're on that route, because it reminds me of that same time period.
Yes.
You remember Closer, the movie?
Oh my goodness.
So, what people don't realize is it was a play, like a famous UK play before that. And the movie actually ends halfway through the book.
Oh.
I guess I'll spoil it. In the end, Alice actually is dead from her recklessness. And everybody has to come to grips over, like, reality, finally, because she's, like, woven this fake reality as a stripper and her manipulation.
If you guys haven't read it or seen the movie, check it out.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Don't take it too seriously.
No. Just if they take it seriously, they take it seriously. You can't help the fans
actually enjoy this.
Okay. If you're disappointed, be disappointed.
Okay.
Either way, it makes you feel something.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, that was fascinating to me.
Okay.
Anyways, I think we're on a banter now. We can do another episode strictly on mixed media. Mixed media. Sure Ryan has plenty of insights.
I mean, if anything, I really enjoyed this conversation because we got to talk about, you know, literature that was applicable.
I think it was cool also because we got to see sort of the paper trail of what shaped what we have now.
Yeah, interactivity.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's not just, you know, we read a story and that's all we want to do. Like, no. Like, some of us actually go to fanfiction.net to actually continue the fandom. Others, they just want to actually play board games and RPGs.
Yeah.
And it is such a relief that the marvel that we get from reading Harry Potter or, what was this, 13th tale doesn't have to actually just end once you finish the book.
That's true.
I love that.
But also on that note, please stop stretching out trilogies into 5-part movies.
Yeah.
just gonna put that out there.
but filmmakers, they don't know what to sell.
Okay. And on that note,
jobs.
Thank you, everyone, for joining.
And keep reading. Because books are better.
Cheers. Thank you, Ryan, for joining us. Cheers.